Well, let's take our heads out of the clouds now and return to Earth. Drawing and the human form are two twin passions of the artist Christopher Orchard. In the year 2000, a bald, portly, middle-aged man, described by Orchard as an avatar, started to appear in his work. In Orchard's own words, this figure represents, quote, the entire history of what it means to be human. Fiona Kroll visits Chris Orchard at his studio just east of Adelaide's CBD.
So we're just walking along the corridor in this big warehouse. The walls are clad in artworks. Let's just go through your door here into your studio.
Trap door in the roller door.
Well, look at it. It's packed. It's packed with paintings, charcoal drawings, hundreds of tubes of paint. Describe the scene that you hang out in.
It's kind of like the inside of my head. It becomes a physical demonstration, I suppose, of what I think about how I think and so forth. It also becomes a kind of bat cave, in a sense, a retreat, a place that all artists go. Some would refer to it as something like imagination's chamber. We go to work. We walk through that door and we are working. You know, you go past some studios, you go past mine, you'll see me sitting in a chair staring at a blank canvas.
So take us through a day in your life as an artist. You've got a blank canvas, then what happens?
Well, for example, there's a drawing here on the wall, a charcoal drawing, which is part of a recent series I've been developing called Push and Pull. But it pretty much encompasses a whole bunch of ideas which we can talk about more completely later. But I think that might be the origins for this canvas. So, for example, I'll finish this drawing and embed it in my thinking. And then I'll go to the canvas and I'll start drawing on there. And I think what I'm doing is then saying, all right, now push and pull, let's have a look. We've got this big, wide panorama of canvas. I think I'd like perhaps six or eight characters spread across that space. I want it to feel claustrophobic. I want the whole thing to feel like they just don't have enough room.
So that drawing you were talking to and referring to is of, well, two bald figures.
Two of the bald figures, two of the bald men. One diagonally across the rectangle with his feet spread and the other on his back, back to back. And he's diagonally pushing his feet up into the top right corner of the rectangle. So one is bearing the weight, the other is exerting pressure on the lower diagonal one. So there's sort of compositional values there. But importantly for me, there's that sense again of that really pressurized space, that whole sense of there's not enough room for two of us, but we're here, so let's make a fist of it.
And would you be having some sort of conversation with that preparatory drawing as you go onto your massive canvas, some sort of non-verbal communication with the canvas?
Oh, yeah.
Take us through that in your mind.
Basically, it would begin with something like the angle of the lower figure. So if we go over to the canvas, which is probably about 1.8 metres wide, best of a metre high, I'd start with that diagonal. That would be in my mind. I think, okay, well, I'll push him to the left of the rectangle. His head will head towards the top left corner. His feet will diagonally head towards about one third into that rectangle. So I'd start thinking about geometries. And so, okay, right, we'll counterpoint that by putting something on the other side of the seesaw. So I'd travel to the other side of the canvas and consider those compositional values and say, yeah, what kind of forces do I want operating over here? Do I want a parallel diagonal? Do I want an oppositional diagonal? And I might draw that five or six times, right?
With charcoal?
I tend to draw with acrylic paint on the canvas, really. And I work tonally in the sense that I begin with very transparent light colour, like Naples yellow, and then I build as my values begin to build and I'm confident of the composition, I begin to use darker colours and then it sort of builds from there. A bit like the world at the moment, really, you know, dot, dot, dot. So it becomes this narration about common experience, and I'm sure everyone's feeling it. And I want this canvas to address them.
So those marks that you're making on the canvas, you're drawing those from memory. You've got there's no people here.
No. And
modelling?
I mean, the bald guy, he emerged roughly about 17, 18 years ago in Sydney. And I went to the bookshop at the Art Gallery in New South Wales and I just chose a book at random off the shelf. It was a book about William Kentridge, great South African artist William Kentridge, who also had a protagonist in his drawings, like these big charcoal drawings and charcoal drawings that he used to make animated films. And I got this kind of sense of confirmation. Rather than negation, I got a kind of confirmation. I think I'm on the right track here, you know. So I really began to pursue this little bald character as an avatar.
So as an avatar, perhaps an alter ego, has he taught you anything over the years? What have you learnt from the bald man?
Well, at an interestingly formal level, there's a kind of phrenology about him. His physicality is so well known to me now. You can see the evidence. I could draw this guy in my sleep, right?
There's about 20 of them. If I just do a little 360 in the studio here, yes, there's about 20 of them in all sorts of different versions. There's decapitated heads, but there's also the full bodies with the ill-fitting suits. So, yeah, they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
You can't escape
everywhere.
The ball.
That's right. He's as universal as Estragon in Waiting for Godot. But apart from that, I think I know him. I know it. Because, strangely enough, he's genderless to me. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, I know it well enough to be able to kind of turn him into the canary in the coal mine. Do you know what I mean? I send him into situations which are of the world, hence the two crowded into a rectangle. I'm just getting... This is a commentary, of course. I think I'm a kind of journalist in the sense that I want to talk about the pressure that the world is under at the moment. You know, this space becomes a metaphor for the fact that we are having trouble dealing with, you know, political order, spatial order. You notice all these guys are levitating, they're about a centimetre off the ground. Well, they can't touch the earth. And there's so many people in the world now who just can't touch the earth, you know, like refugees who are homeless, stateless and so forth. So I use him. I use him mercilessly to meditate on my life, our life, the world, and pretty much gives me an entree.
But we're in that state that, you know, we're fragile, we're not quite sure where we're going perhaps, but he keeps coming back. There's resilience there. There's also humour, I think, when you look around in with this figure. So what is it that makes you bring him back to sort of fight the battle in the world?
Well, I'll give you an example. Several years ago, I went to a performance of Australian Dance Theatre choreographed by Gary Stewart called Worldhood. And I was just captivated because Gary does really risky things with his dancers. He throws them into space. The choreography reminded me of Jackson Pollock throwing paint. And the one thing we've always overlooked, it seems to me, is the thing that captivated Pollock wasn't the end product. It was when the paint was mid-air and it was suspended in space. That fascinated him. I think Gary has the same kind of aesthetic. That is, by throwing his dancers into space, they sort of suspend there momentarily and then they fall and then they suspend again and so forth. I came away from that performance absolutely on fire, and I did a whole series of drawings called Thrown. It was groups of bald men thrown into space. There's one over there in the corner of the studio. It's a largish charcoal. And the men are thrown into a chaotic space with bits of buildings and columns and archways and architecture flying around in space in this kind of melee of what appears to be chaos, but then is potentially, and this is what I got from the dance as well, this sense of being burst into a cluster of possibilities and then reassembling into something new, you know. So that's how my thinking evolved around these thrown characters. It all started with a bunch of dancers on a stage.
And listening to you talk, I mean, drawing is so important to your work. Why did you go down that road? You know, we've been through the 80s, the 90s, when installation was king and drawing was so unfashionable, but you hung in there, you know? You're addicted. Yeah. So why is that?
Well, I think I kept the company of recalcitrant souls. You know, we formed a studio around the Adelaide Central School of Art, which began in 1982, and I guess at the heart of the project, it was never a house style, but everyone who came gravitated together was interested in figuration, the idea of drawing through observation and imagination and so forth. So deeply unfashionable, but at the same time, committed to the idea that this could be and will remain a poignant and powerful language of description in the world.
So can you take us back to that moment where you thought, drawing, I've got to go down that route? You've travelled a lot, you've lived in London, you've been to China, you've been, you know, New York. Take us to that moment that you
I can remember it clearly.
It's coming back.
It was. I'd mounted a really big show called the Link Exhibition, part of the Link Exhibition scheme at Art Gallery South Australia. I majored as a sculptor when I trained as an art teacher, right? So I'd done this massive install at the Art Gallery of South Australia. There was a painting 110 feet long, and it came down onto the floor of the gallery and turned into a trampoline eventually with a biro line in it. And I looked at it after I'd done the install, and I thought, oh man, I don't know. I don't think I'm telling the truth. I don't think I'm really up to it. And I think all artists, writers and candlestick makers have this kind of crisis of confidence, you know. So I pulled away. Julie and I took off and we bought a combi van and we did the hippie trail from Bombay to London and all that sort of stuff. But I went to museums and it dawned on me, I really want to draw. I just really want to be able to draw. So I set about, in a kind of autodidactic way, pursuing the act of drawing over and over and over again and practicing. And then, almost unwittingly, one has radar, I sought out the company of people who do it. So then it took off, and then it was just a long slog. You know, I got a studio in London for a few years, and I was working in the same place as Paula Rego, who draws fiercely and wonderfully figurative work. She's fantastic. And it was like the world became a giant university, you know, a giant art school. And indeed it was. And I just kept pushing and pushing. And I look at some of those drawings now, historically, like drawings of dancers from Sadler's Wells Theatre. They seem to be persistent dancers. Anyway, it's because of the physicality of their bodies. And I look at them now and I think, wow, that's it. There's the beginning of the double helix. The DNA of this character is beginning to form.
And how important is it, those masters of centuries gone by? You know, I can see the drama, like in a Caravaggio, the light and shade that you use, or even some of the surrealist work. That's a bit bonkers, but the execution of artistry is so amazing. Their perspective is brilliant, but then there's like this weird, bizarre thing going on. How important are those sorts of movements to you and the way you think about it?
Great question. I have the good fortune to visit New York often. And I'm going back there this year to do a book launch and mount a solo show. But I always go, there's one little oasis for me, the Morgan Library in New York, who specialise in works on paper. And they have a huge archive. And things often collide at the Morgan. Like last time I was there, I was able to see the drawings of Charlotte Bronte. And down in a gallery downstairs is a giant drawing by Cy Twombly, the great American artist, abstractionist, and so forth. And I just, it's just language is amazing. And then, you know, you can dig into ancient manuscripts at the Morgan and you can see people drawing in the 12th century and the language of the mark and the arabesque of the line. And I saw a drawing by Tintoretto, for example, at the Morgan. I thought, my God, look at that, you know, the etymology of those marks. I find those in my drawing. Not I can do that, but I can do that, you know. And the language echoes across centuries, and you think, you know, maybe it's as relevant now as it's ever been. I can bring elements of the 15th century, 16th century into the 21st century, formal elements of drawing, and turn them into a powerful present language. So these collections are very important. And these artists, you know, they're part of my DNA, yeah.
I was just thinking that, listening to you, that you are so passionate and it is part of your DNA, and you said it. So I can see that you are so driven, but what is it that gets you here out of bed every morning to execute, you know, the little bald man and get in here and work?
Nice one, yeah. Two things. An imminent sense of failure, okay? So I open the door of the studio, God's taken it away, I'll never draw again. Right? That deep mystery that says, will it happen again? Will it happen again? Because every time I approach a piece of blank paper or a blank canvas, I'm as dumb as a post. You know, it's like, I have no history. I have no history of engagement, et cetera, et cetera. It's all a big risk. Here we go again. And as soon as I find the curvature of the cranium or the crook of an arm, it's on for young and old and the story begins, you know. The other thing is, I've got a mind like a public servant. I come at 9 o'clock and I go home at 5. I have a really strict work regime. There's not a lot of long blacks. There's not a lot of cafe work. There's just this space and doggedness. And then you go home.
You're going to have to work a bit later today then, aren't you? Since I've taken up a bit of time. Public servant, you.
If Fiona Kroll speaking with Chris Orchard in his Adelaide studio. And Chris has held over 40 solo exhibitions in Australia and overseas and was the feature artist for last year's South Australian Living Artists Sala Festival, where pretty much every shop, bar and gallery in Adelaide became a venue for artwork. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is Books and Arts.